From bathtub to warehouse, the successful transfer of innovations to the commercial arena. Duncan Smith, Head of Products and Systems Division, and Ruth Thompson, Business Development Consultant at Cambridge Consultants. Welcome and thank you for doing this interview for the Centre for Entrepreneurial Learning's Entrepreneurs and Experts podcast series. Cambridge Consultants is at the heart of the Cambridge phenomenon and celebrated 50 years of innovation in 2010. The company has fostered the development of many early-stage technology companies, right from raising funds to transferring technology to manufactured product. You've both been heavily involved in new product development. So let's talk about how aspiring entrepreneurs should develop their innovations for successful transfer to the commercial environment.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Ruth, you described the new product development process in a rather engaging way as bathtub to warehouse. Can you explain why you've described it like that?
Well, we work with many early stage companies, some really at a very early stage and some with a bit further on. But many of them have started with an initial idea that maybe they've had in the shower, or in the bathtub, or walking to work. And we want to be able to help them to transfer that to having a warehouse full of products. So it's going from that early germination of an idea to having a warehouse full of products.
So people really have that bathtub eureka moment, do they?
We've met quite a lot of people who have had that. And we really want to help them turn that into reality.
Duncan, you've commented that developing a breakthrough new product is not the black art that some would like us to believe. So it's really not as complicated and daunting as it seems. It seems pretty daunting to me.
It can be daunting, and I once heard a talk by someone who said, before you start making a new product, first gain 20 years' experience developing new products, which isn't very helpful if you're just starting out. But the truth is, it's partly about experience and having worked with the kind of people who have done it all before. So surrounding yourselves with people who know how to do it for a different type of market and have got that kind of experience, and not trying to reinvent all the wheels yourselves as a startup.
Because Silicon Valley always says fail and fail fast, so it makes you think, well, you can't be successful first time around.
I don't think that's true. I think you can be successful first time around, but also failing fast is very important. And I think it's very important to keep feedback loops small so that you don't go too far down the road with an idea before you get some feedback as to whether it's a good one or not. Because innovative people will always have a vision of how they're going to succeed. And successful innovators have this lovely future vision of the world in which they're successful. And they're very driven towards achieving that world in their minds of the future. But if they're going to fail, they need to be told quickly so that they can readjust that vision of the future and not get disheartened by that.
So those personal traits, Duncan, that people need and key factors for successful product development, large ego?
Yes, but not so large that you don't know how to get help. I think it's very important that you do have to have a large ego, because you do have to have this vision of the future in which you're a success. And the entrepreneurs we've worked with who have been successful have got that feature. But they're also generally good at partnering with people. They're good at understanding what they're good at. They're good at also understanding the skills of others and building a team around them that can make the whole business success, not just their part of it.
Okay, Ruth, if we turn to you now, how should people decide or evaluate what their first product should be? What's the process? Do you always have that eureka moment in the bathtub thinking, I want to do X, and Y and Z don't come into it?
We meet many people who are trying to get to that mass market application straight away. We would say, well, you know, take a step back and think, what's going to get you fastest to revenue? That's what's going to give you the fastest returns and your investors. So that might not be the mass market application, but if you can get an entry-level product, maybe in a slightly different application that will be easier to market, maybe less competitors, just easier supply chain, for example, then that will get you along your way, then that will be able to fund the way that you can get to that mass market application.
And so the process, you sort of, do you just go and seek out a mentor, go and have drinks at one of the networking parties? You know, what's the first step?
You really need to think about how would someone discredit your idea, and really think about what are the risks in developing that and address those first risks very early on. So you're doing it in a very phased approach. Something that we've really observed is that the investment ladder maps very well onto the product development cycles, because both of them are about reducing risk in stages. So there's different questions that you ask at different points as you're progressing along the investment cycle.
And those would have been researched and people can almost, if you like, follow a formula?
Yes, effectively. I mean, there are standard questions that investors will ask, whether it's at seed funding, at A round and at B round. You know, that obviously they're generic versions which are then applied to that particular product or application that your company is developing. But I think if you take it in a phased approach, rather than trying to do everything at once, that will make you much more successful.
Duncan, you emphasise the need to really understand your customers. What do you mean by that? And what advice would you give to the aspiring entrepreneurs?
This is a trick that startups can learn from big companies. So when big companies are developing a product, they develop what they call a persona, which is the characteristics of the customer they're aiming for. Now, startups quite often make the mistake of trying to sell to themselves or imagining themselves as the customer. And of course, if you only imagine yourself as your customer, you're limiting your market to one person. And of course, that's not realistic. What you've got to do is come up with a generic picture of the type of customer you're selling to. And we actually use visual storyboards for this. So we'll create a storyboard with lots of pictures of things that our target customer might like. So let's say, for example, we're trying to sell a product that's designed for office use, for somebody who's got a very busy desk space, but we're adding a product to their desk space. Let's create a person and give them a name. We might call them Steve, and imagine their life and how busy they are during their day, and actually use visual tools to create a real clear image of what that person's like. And it might be very different from any of the people who are actually involved in the startup. And you can use that as your benchmark for any decision you make about the product. Would Steve like that? Would Steve be able to use that? Would that help Steve in his everyday life? And that really helps, I think, in terms of developing a product for a specific market.
So you don't nip down to Staples and buy yourself a luxury walnut desk. You've got to think of the customer and others. And, you know, if you're sitting on the floor working, it doesn't make any difference.
It's very easy to fall into the trap of just thinking about yourself when you're developing a product. And without a big marketing department around you, which, of course, startups don't generally have, it's easy to fall into that trap. So having a picture on the wall of Steve and all of Steve's life around him, all the kinds of products he likes and the things that he enjoys doing, will help you step outside your own world and imagine Steve's world.
Ruth, do you agree with that, that you know, you've got to visualise Steve first, the customer? Any other factors to consider in getting a new product to market, presumably cost and development costs and how long it will take?
Yes, yeah. I mean, the most importantly, first, you need to know who is your customer, who are you aiming at, you know, and why would they buy it? You know, have you really identified that USP that will really mean that they will buy it? Then knowing your supply chain, you know, knowing how that product is going to reach your customer, because each of those people along that supply chain are going to take a margin, and, you know, on your business case, the only number that's going to shrink is your profit. So you need to really understand your supply chain and the margins they're going to take. The other really important factor is to think, you know, don't forget your competitors are not standing still.
And I suppose, for instance, if you're going to manufacture or sell or market peppermints, it's a very different life cycle to if you've got a new biotech product, which might take years to come on stream.
Yes, of course. And they've both got different supply chains and different factors to consider. But educating yourself about the supply chain, getting around you advisors who understand that world will help you move much faster.
Having said that, whether or not you're developing a biotech product or a consumer product, the product development process is very similar. Timescales can be different, but this idea of reducing risk in steps and having a phased approach, which means that at each stage you're reducing risks, that coincides with funding rounds. So at early stage you're reducing the really big risks and showing investors that you've understood the big technical risks. And then as you go on, as the investment rises, you're reducing more and more risk. That works whichever type of sector you're in, and it's very a happy coincidence, as Ruth said, that the funding ladder for startups maps so well onto good practice product development, and that's true for medical as well as consumer and other markets.
Well, Ruth, the Centre for Entrepreneurial Learning's Entrepreneurs and Experts podcast series, we've heard from quite a lot of experts in this field. But if we're now this young or old entrepreneur sitting down wanting to get some seed funding for our new product, how do we prepare for the tough questioning from investors about our products? What would they want to know about us?
I really remember, these investors, they're smart people. They've got to where they are.
But that's
smart.
The terrifying thing.
Yes. So, and what we've often found is, we've sat down before with an entrepreneur that we're working with and thought through maybe the top 10 questions that they might ask. And they've come in and they've asked, always like about 8 or 9 or even 10 of the questions that we predicted. The way to understand that, you could do something like, devil's advocate exercises to try and think of, the questions that they could ask. Or think about, if you were your competitor, how would you discredit what you're trying to do? And thinking around it in that kind of way, you can come up with those really difficult questions.
If we're going to look at the risks at each stage and what they are and what they involve, would one of you like to have a go at saying sort of what the risks are and what stage? And is one stage riskier than the next?
It's always riskier at the beginning, which is, of course, why early stage investors are prepared to take the risk if reward is high enough. We talk a lot about risk assessment in product development, and it always sounds dull because it sounds like health and safety, but risk assessment is vital, and there are ways, like Ruth says, of making it more interesting by turning it into a game and imagining scenarios. But we do it in a structured way, and really the important thing is to identify the risks that you can afford to tackle early on, because there will be some risks that are high risk that would require a lot of cost to solve. So problems that you can't solve now because you can't afford to with the stage of funding you're at. Whereas there'll be some risks that are only low risks that are relatively straightforward to reduce. And you have to have a method for choosing where to spend your time with the limited resources you have. And really the best ones to go for are the ones that are relatively high risk, but that you can see that if you put a small amount of effort in, you can demonstrate to an investor how you're going to solve that problem, whether that's a technical risk or whether it's a commercial risk. So it might be to do with an experiment you can do to demonstrate an aspect of your technology that will make a big difference to the investor. Or it may be a commercial risk. It may be that you simply haven't understood the supply chain and the margins involved in the different parts of your supply chain. So there may be that commercial element. Or it may be simply that you can't visualize easily what you're trying to sell. So we do a lot of work with looks-like demonstrators that don't work, but that allow you to put something in the hands of an investor that is representative of what the final product is going to be like. And that can be very powerful, because if you can put it in their hand and they can feel it and they can understand how it's going to work, it can really make it become real in a way that just PowerPoint slides or talking can't do.
And particularly if we have your visualization of your client, Steve, in our minds as well. If you know that Steve wants this and why he wants it, is that how Steve Jobs went about designing Apple products?
I think Steve Jobs, by all accounts, is quite unusual because he's so dictatorial about the design himself. But having said that, that's exactly how a startup needs to behave. You have to have this person who has a vision of the future in which they're successful. And in this case, it's a vision of the future in which Steve, who's our target customer, has this product, this model I've got in my hand, and it's really having an impact on his life. And if you can show that to an investor, if you can show how Steve's going to benefit from this thing you've got in your hand, then the investor's much more likely to be able to see how the revenue is going to flow from that, and then will be more likely to invest.
Okay, Duncan, just coming on to the more technical terms now. Now, you talked about a model of proof of concept to a potential investor. What do they want to see? Is that about intellectual property rights?
I think IP is always important to investors. They will want to see that something works. So typically, with an early stage startup, you'll have a mixture of different sorts of prototypes. So you might have the looks like model I mentioned, which is something that looks like the real thing but doesn't have to work, but it can be animated. It doesn't have to be just a block model. It could light up and have some functionality that makes it more real. Equally, you'll want, for a technology startup, you're very likely to have some kind of lab-based demonstrator, some kind of thing that doesn't look like the real thing but shows that the technology actually works, and that there's a a gap between what we have now and what we will have in production, but we can close that gap. We can show how we're going to get from where we are now to where we're going to be by the time it's in production. So it may still need a year or 2 years or 5 years for a medical product of development, but you can see how we're going to get there. So it's a mixture of having these things that look real and things that work sufficiently well that they bridge the credibility gap for investors.
And do you agree, Ruth, would you sort of follow these stages? And what do you think a good prototype should demonstrate?
Yes, yeah, I agree completely. The demonstrator is addressing those key questions that you've identified to be important for your company. So whether the looks like issue is a really, really important factor for your USP, and using works like models to address those really difficult technical questions. Now, as you move further on and as the company matures and as you do further work, you're addressing different questions as you go up the investment ladder. Maybe later you're really needing to prove you can make it like that. You know, for example, you could have a product that they're saying, well, it is going to be this small. So you've got to prove that you can actually get it in that small box and be able to show that you can miniaturise the, whether it's electronics or whatever the components are, to be able to actually fit in that box. But the demonstrator should answer the questions that investors are asking at that particular point.
Duncan, you talked about Apple and the iPod. Good design, is that really key? Or could you perhaps brush up on the design but get the marketing spot on?
Yes, I think it depends on your market. For consumer devices, I think design is essential. Increasingly, that's also true for things like medical devices, where there's a big push towards compliance for example, drug delivery devices, where it's very important that they're easy to use for the patient, because ease of use will improve the compliance for the drug regime and actually will improve the efficacy, which means that the cost of the drug program will be reduced and the cost to the provider will be reduced. That all stems back from having something that's easy to use, which in turn stems back to us, to Steve, so to understanding our target customer and their lifestyle and finding something that will fit in with their environment. And I think that is all about good design, whether it's just pure aesthetics or, more importantly, whether it's about ease of use, and not only ease of use of your product, but understanding what else they're doing at the time, because people have busy lives, and good design is about understanding what else they might be doing while they're using a product, not just the product itself.
Well, we seem to have come a long way on this entrepreneurial journey in the Centre for Entrepreneurial Learning's Entrepreneurs and Experts podcast series today. But we've had that eureka moment, Ruth, in the bath. We've thought through what our investors want to say to get seed funding. We've worked out the design of our product. The next stage is to commercialise the product, actually being able to manufacture a warehouse full. What do people need to think about when we call it scaling up a product, don't we?
You need to have considered this early, and it's part of what we talked about earlier of understanding that supply chain and who's going to be involved and where are the margins going to be. You should understand who is going to manufacture it, where is it going to be manufactured. You know, maybe it's going to be manufactured in parts and they have to be brought together, combined elsewhere. But having understood that earlier, this stage that you're able to have designed it for manufacture, hopefully with those people involved, that will mean much smoother transfer to a manufacturer.
Okay, now both of you, Ruth and Duncan, you've talked about enjoying working with innovative technologies which benefit the end user and perform in the commercial environment. Could you perhaps talk about one or two of the new products you've been really excited about and how they've been developed, if it's not all still under wraps, Duncan?
Well, we can talk about a product that's just on the market now, which we were heavily involved in. We came up with the original idea of a radio that connects to the internet, but that has very, very simple user interface. So rather than having to scroll through thousands of stations, you pick your favourite four, and then it's cube-shaped, and you simply rotate it to change between your favourite channels, and you tilt it to change the volume. Very simple idea that one of my colleagues came up with, and we used exactly the process we've described of creating both a looks-like demonstrator that we could put into the hands of an investor and works-like demonstrators that were on the bench to help get buy-in to this idea. And we work with a company called the Armour Group who have brought that product to market. And one of the nice things for me as a product developer is that the final product on the shelf is almost exactly the same as that very first prototype that my colleague put on my desk. And it's lovely to see a product where the vision hasn't changed. So we knew that this was a simple idea, and that if we took it to market in this simple way, it would really have an impact. And to see it embodied in really the same form without having had its every other feature added to it and have it compromised by lots of design committees is a really nice thing to see in the market.
Ruth?
The world of healthcare devices are starting becoming connected. This is helping people be able to monitor their own healthcare as the wellness trend continues, and as we're needing to find better ways of helping people become compliant with their medication. This is another trend that we see in consumer devices, and we're now seeing it in healthcare and in areas such as smart metering, where you're getting products that have previously been standalone products are now service-based systems. They're connected to the cloud.
And I know the cloud is something you think is the future too, with a lot of new products, Duncan.
Yes, and I think it's very hard sometimes to make these sorts of things tangible, because you're talking about products that connect to cloud-based services, and it's hard to be able to describe that. And it's very helpful to have demonstrators that can help make that easier for people to understand. So, for example, having an inhaler with that's connected to the internet on its own doesn't sound very appealing, but when you can visualize the impact it can have on the life of a patient by using demonstrators, it's that much more tangible, and we're seeing a lot of innovation in that area at the moment.
Well, first of all, I think I ought to congratulate you both for helping others develop innovative products. Your stamina and your knowledge, I've learned so much. Ruth and Duncan, thank you for doing this interview for the Centre for Entrepreneurial Learning's Entrepreneurs and Experts podcast series, From Bathtub to Warehouse, the Successful Transfer of Innovations to the Commercial Arena.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.